From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour is a 29-year military veteran. In any job over the course of 29 years, there are going to be decisions and policies made by those above you that you're not going to agree with, but you continue to do your job. And that was certainly the case for retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright. But America's decision to go to war in Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein without the authorization of the UN Security Council was something that she simply couldn't condone in her mind or by her continued presence as a representative of the U.S. government. At the time, Colonel Wright was a member of the U.S. Foreign Service, serving as Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia. Her resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell came the day before our invasion in Iraq, and she was not alone. Although we haven't heard much about them, others throughout our government and military also chose to leave in protest. Many of those who left did so because they felt it more important to honor their oath to uphold the Constitution rather than serve a particular president or administration. And many of them did so at considerable personal loss. Colonel Wright tells her story and those of several others, more than several actually, in a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why this book now?
Well, it's an opportune time for us to really reflect on what's happened in the lead up to the war in Iraq. Because we're kind of in the same mode right now about another country of interest that's on the axis of evil list of the Bush administration, and that's Iran, and whether or not we will have men and women of our government that will speak out before this administration perhaps goes to war in Iran.
And I guess usually when I ask the question, why this book now, it has a different subtext. In this case, what I mean is, why not 3 years ago? Why not 4 years ago? Why not the year after you resigned? I mean, obviously, some of the material that's in the book would not be in the book had you written it then, but why?
Well, actually, it took a long time for me to collect the stories of these men and women. They weren't really well publicized in our media. And we also reflect on people in other governments, the British government. The British had four times more people who resigned than the U.S. did.
Yeah, well, that was what shocked me. It was an extraordinary number, including the leader of the House of Commons, among others. And I want to talk to you about Tony Brown later on, Tony Blair, later on in our conversation. Was there any other government policy, because you served in the Army and the Army Reserves for years, and then you went to the Foreign Service, was there any other policy or military campaign throughout your career with which you disagreed as vehemently as this one?
Well, there were plenty of very unpopular policies, if you look back through the eight different presidential administrations that I served under, starting with joining the military during the Vietnam War, a very unpopular war, during the administration of Lyndon Johnson. And one could say, well, why in the world would you join during the time of war? And already the people of America were saying, why are we in there? But I joined the military like so many other young people do. It's not that you want to go kill anyone. It's not that you are joining really for the war. It's that you join to have an opportunity for further education later through the GI Bill, that you want to get job skills, you want to escape something. For me, I wanted to escape the state of Arkansas, where I grew up. So I joined during a time of an unpopular war. I was in administrations during invasions of Grenada, of Panama, the Iran-Contra, Gulf War I, aspects of which were unpopular within the American public. For those things that I felt that I'm a little uneasy about policies, and sometimes it's not even war policies. There are other policies that administrations cook up that career military or career civil service or foreign service people go, oh, my God, where did they come up with this crazy thing? But you go ahead and stay in the government. Maybe not. Well, I never worked on the programs that I did not agree with. But there were plenty of other programs that our government always has that one can get into that you feel like you're not harming anyone. In fact, you may be helping our own country as well as people of other countries. So I was able to kind of channel my energies in areas where I felt like I was doing good, even though there were some policies that an administration was doing that we knew were very unpopular domestically and internationally.
You mentioned Vietnam a second ago, and in the book you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which escalated the war in Vietnam, and that was completely bogus, we have come to find out. We didn't know it then, but we know it now. Had you known it then, would you have acted the way you have acted since the Iraq invasion? Obviously, you were in the military. You couldn't just get up and walk out, but some have in this book.
Absolutely.
Some have gotten up and walked out.
Yes. Some have tried to walk out. Junior military can't really walk out.
Right.
They end up getting court-martialed, and many of them going to prison for saying, no, I will not participate in what I now consider to be an illegal criminal act by our government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one of the things that pushed me to resign in March of 2003 is that in my mind at that point, the decision of the administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States, and the inability of the U.S. to get the authorization of the U.N. Security Council for military operations on behalf of the entire international community, I felt we didn't have a legal basis to go into Iraq. And that's in contrast to, say, Gulf War I, where after long discussions, the United States finally joined and voted with the U.N. Security Council that there should be military operations to remove Saddam Hussein from Kuwait.
You resigned from the State Department when you resigned. You had retired from the military.
That's
at
right.
The time.
Yes.
And were working, as I said, in Mongolia. Since I didn't know this until I read your book, but since 1971, you write, as a result of State Department professionals at the time feeling that their views on the Vietnam War were going unheard, the State Department initiated something called the Dissent Channel for contrary viewpoints, and things that get filtered into the Dissent Channel were designed to go directly to the Secretary of State so he could read other people's opinions of what was going on. Does it work, or is it a waste of time?
Well, it depends on whether you think that just the fact that you've been able to get your message up to the senior person in your organization, the Secretary of State, if that, I mean, that is the purpose of it. It is not working in terms of the administration listening to you. For example, I did use that dissent channel before I resigned. I used it about a month before to let Colin Powell directly know, without any filtering of my words through my ambassador in Mongolia, through the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, and, you know, through my chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to hear from little old Ann Wright, sitting way out in Mongolia, that I had serious, grave concerns about the United States going to war in Iraq.
As a former officer in the military, in the Army, I don't think a similar chain of back channel exists, but if somebody, if a private or a corporal had come to you about an operation that you were in charge of, what would your reaction have been? Would you have listened?
Well, that's a good point. It really is. You know, how do senior officers in any organization take the criticisms, the dissent of junior people?
Mm-hmm.
And it really has great bearing on what's going on right now, where you have very junior members of our military who are standing up to say, listen, four-star generals, if you can't figure this out, I can figure it out. I think this is an illegal war, and here's my rationale. The statements of conscience that we put in the book are amazing.
Yeah.
Of 17, 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-olds who have really done legal analysis, they've done moral analysis, and they are saying to their senior commanders, and the commanders aren't listening. I guess that's the answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
The commanders really aren't listening.
Would you have listened?
I think I would have, but I think I would have been bound probably in the same manner that these officers today are. We haven't found any officers of our military really stepping out, with the exception. Now, if you look at General Shinseki, the chief of staff of the Army, before the Gulf War, before the Iraq War started,
mm-hmm.
he was asked under oath by the U.S. Congress, do we have enough military troops in our war plans to meet the obligations of the United States if we invade and occupy Iraq? And General Shinseki said, under oath, no, we don't. And that was in total opposition to what Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had said, that we are going to go in lean and mean into Iraq. We don't need all these people. We're going to have high-tech drones and all these other things.
You go in with the army that you have, not the army that you wish you had.
That you wish you had. That's right. We don't need to worry about these vehicles that don't have armor on them and against what turned out to be the extraordinary use of these improvised explosive devices. Yeah. But General Shinseki, to the Congress, under oath, said, no, we don't have enough people to meet our international obligations of protecting people. You know, because when a country invades another country, you have international legal obligations to keep people alive, the civilians alive, to feed them, house them, water, sewage, electricity. You're supposed to prevent chaos, prevent looting, prevent the infrastructure from being torn apart as a consequence of war. And Shinseki said, no, we don't have enough people. We lack several hundred thousand people. And Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld cut him off at the knees.
Yeah, yes, he was discredited. Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft, who was in previous administrations, also said this is misguided. General Anthony Zinni, Lieutenant General William Odom, Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, these are people all in your book, Major General Paul Eaton, Major General John Batiste.
The latter two said it after they retired, though, several years afterwards. The other one said before the war really started. They were talking about it.
But it's critical in the military that the military follow orders, and that in this country, at least, they follow the orders of the civilian command. That is exactly who we are as a people, and that can't be changed. It shouldn't be changed, because the civilian people have got to have control over the military or our system won't work.
Absolutely.
So when you have disagreement this severe, they have no choice, do they, but either to follow the orders or resign. And if you're an enlisted man or a junior officer, you can't resign. You follow your orders. It puts people in a very, very precarious moral situation.
It does, and you can see that from the numbers, the very few numbers of people that we have that ever dissent, whether they be civilian or military, that it is a huge dilemma for them. Over 400 people contacted me after I resigned, 400 people from the Foreign Service, to say, we know this war in Iraq is going to be a disaster for the United States and certainly for Iraq. We think things should ought to be handled in a different manner to undercut Saddam Hussein, but we wish we could resign, but we've got kids in college, we've got mortgages, we've got all these financial obligations, and if all of us would resign, then the administration could pack the Foreign Service with their political appointees. So there's always some way that you can rationalize why you don't take a stand.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk some more about your resignation from the Foreign Service and what's happened since your resignation, and more about this book, Dissent, Voices of Conscience, by our guest today, Colonel Ann Wright, U.S. Army retired. We'll come back in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by the McCall Center for Visual Art, now registering for the Summer Arts Institute for Children, ages 6 to 13. Week-long visual art classes, June 16th through August 8th. Class listings at mccallcenter.org. And by Tyler 2 Construction, celebrating 25 years of building the community. Many thanks to our clients, business partners, subcontractors, and associates for 25 years. Tyler2Construction.com. The 2, by the way, is a numeral. Tyler2Construction.com. Tomorrow, another edition of Open Phones. We haven't done this for a while, so hopefully your cup runneth over. Hopefully you have a lot of things to say, whether it's about the economy and the rising price of food and gasoline, or the presidential race, or what we're talking about today, and whether or not we should be in Iraq, what we should do now, or about Charlotte's new police chief, or crime, whatever's on your mind. It's fuel for the flames tomorrow at 9.
The Mexican government has deployed close to 30,000 troops to fight increasingly violent drug cartels. The nation's top drug enforcement agent was assassinated earlier this month. Many say the killing signals a new and more dangerous phase in that country's battle against drug traffickers. An update on Mexico's drug wars. The Diane Rehm Show, Tuesday.
The Diane Reams Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Marine boot camp takes 13 weeks, and it's no picnic. One Marine recruiter says there's a reason for the harsh treatment.
To talk in a sweet, loving manner is not going to get the message across in regards to safety, in regards to why we do things the certain way we do it. It's only for 13 weeks.
Selling today's 18-year-olds on the Marines. That's coming up next time on The World. Tonight at 7 on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back in our Spirit Square studio with Colonel Ann Wright, U.S. Army retired and a former member of the State Department's Foreign Service. She resigned on the day before the American invasion of Iraq. She was the third State Department official, I believe, to resign in advance of that war. Her book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. Daniel Ellsberg wrote the foreword to your book. He's the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers, about which there was much furor during the Nixon administration. It turns out to be that he did the country a favor, but at the time he was being painted as a criminal and as a traitor, etc. But he wrote the foreword to your book, and he calls the Congress to hold hearings to call you and some of the other government insiders who resigned as a result of the war to testify as to what, quote, was knowable at the time about how what was known was suppressed within the bureaucracy, concealed from the public, and lied about at the highest levels. That has not occurred.
No, it certainly hasn't.
Do you wonder why?
Yes. And there are plenty of government officials that should be called, that knew exactly that the intelligence information that the administration was putting out, the president and the vice president, secretary of state and secretary of defense were giving out, was tainted, that it had been fixed, that it had cherry-picked.
In that big speech he gave at the UN, did he know? Because he said, he's come back since and said something along the lines that it's something he'll be embarrassed about or troubled about the rest of his life.
Well, that's right. And of all people, he should have known. I mean, he had been the national security advisor during the latter part of the Reagan administration. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the Bush 1 administration. Mm-hmm. Even though out of office for 8 years, all of these guys keep in touch with folks. When he came back in as Secretary of State, he had 2 years to ask the questions that he would know to ask about, come on, tell me about these weapons of mass destruction. What's been going on for these 12 years that we've had two no-fly zones over the country, that we've had sanctions on the country, that we've been having all of our satellites watching what's going on, UN inspectors having been in there for 6 years and then allowed back in by Saddam Hussein for 3 months. The UN inspectors being composed a lot of by U.S. military and CIA intel analysts being on those UN teams. So I think he of all people, knew. And as his chief of staff, retired Army Colonel Larry Wilkerson now says, you know, that they threw out 90% of what the CIA and everybody else was giving them and just kind of cherry-picked parts that were left to present, although he hasn't come out to say, knowing full well we knew that even this was smelly stuff.
The bulk of your book, and the book is about 25-30 pages without the appendix, the bulk of your book are the stories of people who have protested, resigned, left the country, gone AWOL from the military, members of the British government who were discredited or resigned because of their opposition to this war, letters of resignation which spell out in clear detail why these people are leaving the government in protest. But if you read nothing in this book but the first 22 pages in which you lay out everything that pretty much we know now about what happened in the roll-up to the war and what has happened since, and if that information is true, if 50% of that information is true, it's infuriating. Why do you suppose none of this has been looked into by anybody, including the Democratic Congress?
Well, I'm very disappointed in the Democratic Congress because here now they have the opportunity to have official hearings, congressional hearings on the lead up to the war. You know, the British government did have hearings. It was called the Butler Inquiry. And one of the British diplomats who had been tracking weapons of mass destruction for 4 years while he was at the United Nations, he ended up resigning. First he testified, well, he resigned, then he provided his testimony to the Butler Commission about how there was nothing that he ever saw during his time of monitoring weapons of mass destruction that indicated that there were any there in Iraq. We have not had a similar thing to the Butler Commission, and it's pitiful where finally we get the opposition power in party, and it's their responsibility to hold such hearings, and they won't
and they
do
don't.
It.
And why? Because you were arrested in Senator John Conyers' office, is that correct?
Congressman John Conyers', office, yes.
You were arrested several times, but you were arrested in his office for protesting. And what was his rationale for not wanting to look into this?
Well, we were arrested. We had gone to say we think that we need to have some accountability, and the investigations that could lead to the impeachment of a president, vice president, which would be actually the inquiry into what got us into war. And John Conyers told us specifically that the Democrats winning the 08 election was more important than holding the Republicans accountable and more important than ending the war in Iraq right now.
But it's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's about legal versus illegal, moral versus immoral, if these allegations were to be proven true. It's about criminal activity, if these allegations are to be proven true, not just internationally criminal activity under international law, but under the U.S. Constitution, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And as we told John Conyers, you know, he works for us, the people, and the people elected this Congress to hold people accountable, to have investigations, and for him not to do his job, and for Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House to say impeachment's off the table virtually the day that she arrived as the Speaker of the House is, in my opinion, the dereliction of duty on their part.
John Brady Kiesling is the first diplomat to resign over this policy of going to war in Iraq, and you print his resignation letter, and in it he says, "The policies we are now asked to advance are incompatible not only with American values, but also with American interests." Strong words. Why didn't hundreds of people in the Foreign Service, in the State Department, throughout the government join him?
Well, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of personal financial interests that people think about when they make these decisions of whether or not they should stay in a position, whether it's in the corporate world or whether it's in government service, although one could certainly say in this incident, the danger to our country outweighs any other type of predicament you could be facing. And it really has disheartened me because I know that there are so many people who are desperately concerned about our country that are in government service. And I guess it's not really much of a tradition in our country, whereas in the British government, apparently they do have a tradition of resignation and that resignation not being held against them, so to speak, that it's kind of a badge of honor that and people who have resigned in one administration are invited mm-hmm. back into another.
If I read your book correctly, and I didn't know this, if this is true, that the British government had to make a case for the legality of the war, because unlike our system of government, their military would not have gone if they thought the war was illegal. So their attorney general, essentially, had to make a statement to Parliament laying out his case for the legality of the war and file a piece of paper with that statement on it with Parliament. He made a kind of truncated statement, but his paper statement, which was not released to Parliament, against British law, mm-hmm. did not make the case that he made verbally, as I understand this. Is that correct?
Well, that's right.
And that was leaked to the British papers.
Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, had consistently, until about 10 days before the war, had been giving Tony Blair advice, as had all the other legal advisors in the various departments, to include the legal advisor of the British Foreign and Commercial Commonwealth Office, their equivalent of the State Department. that there was no legal basis to go to war in Iraq, that British interests had not been jeopardized, threatened by Saddam Hussein, and the UN Security Council had not voted for military operations. So those two legal bases, which are the primary two that are used, were not available. With the deputy legal counsel of the British Foreign Service, Elizabeth Willemshurst, even resigned over this, saying that if you go to war, you are committing an act of aggression, which is a war crime. And she also put in her letter of resignation that Lord Goldsmith, who had just changed his mind 10 days before the war, and all of a sudden he gave Tony Blair what Tony Blair wanted, which was a legal basis, a legal opinion that, yes, you can go on and you won't be prosecuted for war crimes. Now, one can guess what the threat was from Tony Blair to Lord Goldsmith. Goldsmith, if you don't give me that legal opinion, you better find yourself another job, because I'm going to get me somebody in there that will give me that opinion.
You also print documents leaked to the British press in advance of the invasion that clearly state that many in the British government believed any invasion would be illegal under international law, that no one in their government or ours had the, quote, faintest idea of what Iraq would be like after we went in. No one had thought about, and this is based on conversations between our two governments, no one had thought about what would happen after we toppled Saddam. As a military person, isn't that simply inconceivable?
It is, because all of the military plans always have this annex called the Civil Military Operations Annex, which lays out what happens after you invade a country.
Well, if this is true, what in God's name were they thinking?
Well, they were thinking that their good friends, the Iraqi exiles, people like Ahmed Chalabi, had a clue what was going on. But he didn't have a clue. He hadn't been in Iraq in decades.
Was this hubris? Was this naivete? Was it ignorance? What was it?
I think it's a combination of all three of them. And it was a purposeful pushing aside of anyone who was questioning the administration's decision to do this. Pushing aside people like Brent Scowcroft, who was giving him advice well ahead of time, pushing aside Tony Zinni, pushing aside members of the State Department who behind the scenes were telling him, listen, this is, you just can't do all of these things the way you're going to do them.
We could sit here and psychoanalyze the American government forever, but let's take just a second and psychoanalyze the British government.
Mm-hmm.
What was in it for Tony Blair? Because in these documents that were leaked to the British press and all these people's letters of resignation, it's clear that Tony Blair wanted, the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, wanted to go to war with us in Iraq. Why?
I think it was that Tony Blair wanted to, he kind of liked being with the big dog, so to speak. And if the United States was doing something and the British government didn't go along with it, they would be left behind. That he wouldn't have the access to George Bush as he had the access to Bill Clinton, even though there was not the same level of military participation on international issues as this one was going to cause. I really think it was an ego thing for Tony Blair.
Wow. You have, in addition to a military background for 29 years and working in the State Department for
16 years,
mm-hmm. you have a legal background mm-hmm. as well. And you say that the United States invasion of Iraq could be classified under the terms of the Geneva Convention as a war crime, and that because of the Bush administration's highly successful propaganda campaigns, your words, and a huge media failure in the United States, most of us, most Americans, didn't realize until recently how often the Bush administration has violated both domestic and international law. Give me some examples.
Well, certainly the invasion and occupation of Iraq is one of them. How about torture? The brutalization of men and women that we've had in jails in Afghanistan and Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Now torture as a national policy of the United States, where we have the President of the United States that vetoes a congressional bill that said torture is illegal, which is has been our law and in compliance with international law, and the President of the United States vetoes it. We have an Attorney General that will not say that waterboarding is torture. How about what I consider to be the illegal incarceration for 7.5 years of persons in Guantanamo without charges being filed against them.
But they are enemy combatants.
Well, let's see. We've had 800 people that have been in Guantanamo. Over 500 have been released. 95% of everyone that's been in Guantanamo, we purchased. We didn't capture them on a field of battle. We bought them through a bounty program. And for us to hold them without investigating them, or investigating them and continuing to hold them when we knew that they had nothing to do with the incidents of 9/11, nor shooting at American soldiers.
And maybe you, or it could be somebody else in your book, takes issue with the term enemy combatants.
Well, that's right. The it is a new term of art that's being used. I think we should go ahead and use the Geneva Conventions for the protection not only of the people that we capture by somehow come into our possession, but for the protection of our own U.S. military, because now our military is in great jeopardy. We don't have the moral high ground to say to others, listen, we don't torture people. We don't keep people decades at a time without any legal process for them. Now, so if our guys and gals in our military get captured, what are we going to say to the
those who we no longer have the moral high ground.
That's right.
Many people who have spoken out, even mildly, against this war have been accused by the Bush administration of being unpatriotic, if not treasonous. This is out of character, I would think, for you as a 29-year military veteran. What has been the reaction of people you know, people you love, people you've worked with in the past to your condemnation of this and your speaking out against this?
Well, I have been fortunate that I haven't received the brunt force of those who call me call people unpatriotic and treasonous. Although a couple of the Bush TV folks, like Bill O'Reilly, I've been on his show once. That
You did something most guests don't get a chance to do on Bill O'Reilly. You challenged him. You took him to task. Although he did his best not to let you talk.
Yeah, I ended up cutting off my mic, but when I challenged him on what his credentials were to do an analysis of the Geneva Conventions and treatment of prisoners, cut off my microphone.
Well, you and Phil Donahue are two of the people that stick out in my mind as people who have had their way with Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree.
To a degree. Well, but, you know, I think one of the things is that my background, I mean, people can challenge my analysis, but they sure can't challenge that I have been in the government for long periods of time and through successive administrations.
But we were attacked, and we are at war on two fronts. Are you being unpatriotic? You, a military person, aren't supporting the troops in some people's minds. Tell me why what you're doing is patriotic.
Well, I support the troops, but I just don't support putting troops into a position or a policy that I believe is illegal. And I think it's my responsibility to speak up with my background in both the military and the Foreign Service, that I would be unpatriotic if I didn't speak out. With my background, my knowledge.
But aren't we aiding the enemy when we complain about our policies vocally in an international world where the news goes around the world in seconds?
Well, I think we're creating more enemies if we don't have a rational policy. And the people of the world think that the American government has gone crazy. Mm. We're causing our own problems, I'm afraid, by these policies.
Colonel Ann Wright's our guest. We'll come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Hendrick Lexus in Charlotte, featuring the innovative RX400H with Lexus Hybrid Drive. More information is available at HendrickLexus.com. And by Sharp Business Systems, providing a network of offices throughout the Carolinas, offering services to local businesses as well as corporations. Sharp Business Systems, where the accent is still on quality. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reem Show, the Mexican government has deployed close to 30,000 troops to fight increasingly violent drug cartels. The nation's top drug enforcement officer was assassinated earlier this month, and many say the killing signals a new and more dangerous phase in that country's battle against drug traffickers. An update on Mexico's drug wars in the 10 o'clock hour. And then at 11 o'clock, the former Republican Congressman Mickey Edwards explains his belief that the conservative movement has abandoned its principles and transformed from the best defender of the Constitution to its most threatening opponent. He has a book called Reclaiming the Constitution. He's a lecturer at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School and a former Republican congressman from Oklahoma. He joins Diane Rehm at 11. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or join our blog, wfae.org/charlotteblogs. We're coming right back.
Enjoy a night at the theater on us. 90.7 WFAE is giving away a limited number of tickets to Charlotte Squawks, a parody of pop culture, politics, and all things Queen City. You can enter today at wfae.org/squawks to win a pair of tickets to WFAE Night, June 5th at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. Get all the details at wfae.org.
Despite rising prices for everyday items, some Charlotte residents are still finding room in their budgets to put money away.
I'm saving now where I used to couldn't save before, if it's nothing but $5.
Listen for WFAE's Faces of Charlotte's Economy series tomorrow at 6:35 and 8:35 during Morning Edition on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is retired Army Colonel Anne Wright and a former member of the U.S. Foreign Service who resigned her post in Mongolia the day before the American invasion of Iraq. She's written a book about all this. FBI agents, Justice Department attorneys, national security specialists, diplomats, active duty military, and others are profiled in this book, Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. Before we go to the phones and the emails that I have here from folks, you make some strong allegations in this book about the president having an Iraq focus right out of the starting gate, almost the day after the first inauguration, designing a new national security strategy for the country that dovetailed with a report written in the 90s by the Project for a New American Century that advised a preemptive strike on Iraq. Why would there be this focus on Iraq?
Well, oil is the three-letter word for that one, energy resources. And if you read the Project for the New American Century document, it says that it's America's destiny. It's its time. It needs to control the resources to continue a way of life that is so out of sync, really, with the rest of the world in terms of its huge consumption of resources, that we have to invade other countries to control the resources that will spur the economy on.
My God, that's not only arrogant, it's un-American.
Well, certainly to the rest of the world it is.
I don't give an opinion on this program very often, but I don't think I'm wrong, so I'll say it.
Yeah.
You also say motivations could have included political capital gained from being a war president, war profiteering for administration friends, and the opportunity to reverse Saddam's decision to sell oil for euros rather than for dollars, which could have devastated our economy. The only one of these motivations, it seems to me, that is even remotely defensible is the last one.
Well, if you look at what's going on right now in Iraq, I mean, the level of oil production right now is very low compared to what it could be, and I think it's low because the Bush administration is purposefully putting pressure on the Iraqi government. Keep it low until we can get better control of other aspects of the oil cartel, and then we'll let the oil flow. And that's at the expense of the Iraqi people who essentially in one of the most oil-laden places in the world virtually have no gasoline.
Why do you say that? Why do you believe that?
Well, I think there are the connections between the Bush administration and the oil companies of not only the United States but of the world are very, very strong. There are a lot of people. The Bush friends have gotten extraordinarily rich from this war. corporations.
So you're saying that while we're paying $4 a gallon, and the president is over there begging the Saudis to open the tap so we can lower prices, and he's saying we're not going to put any oil into the oil strategic oil reserve to help minimally, that at the same time he's telling the Iraqis not to open the tap. So that's what you're saying.
Yes. And, I mean, we don't have to pay $4 a gallon. There are ways to get around that. You could put government controls on the amount of profits that oil companies can make. I mean, this is a capitalist system. I acknowledge that, and profits make the world go round. But when you have successive quarters where every major oil company has made the highest profits in the history of the world every quarter, then I think that should give an indication that perhaps the profits are a little excessive. And maybe rather than having it off the back of the working people of America and the world, that maybe we ought to reduce the profits of the oil companies. They can still make a profit, but it doesn't have to be that we have to torpedo our whole lives. Although on one level, it is good for America, I think, that we acknowledge that we have got to change some of our ways of doing things, and developing other energy resources is definitely high overdue.
I want to get into the phone calls here, but you also, in this statement I just read, you alleged war profiteering for administration friends. That would, I guess, mean Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and Halliburton and others. And you get into that a little bit in this book, particularly about no-bid contracts and the release of people who have, prior to this administration, been in charge, who hold offices that have been in charge of seeing to it that these multi-billion-dollar contracts go to the companies that bid properly in the best interests of the American people. And you say that those people have been dispatched post-haste and they've been dispensed with.
Indeed. Bunnatine Greenhouse, who is a top procurement officer, top contracting officer for the Army Corps of Engineers, and that organization has issued a huge number of the contracts for work in Iraq. Bunnatine Greenhouse raised the flag early in the war saying, we cannot do sole source bidding, give a contract to a company without having a bidding process. Even in time of war, we have expedited processes where major companies that we know that can fulfill these contracts, that they can get their bids in real quickly, and then to protect the American taxpayer, we can make a decision with a bidding process. And she was told by the senior person in the Army Corps of Engineers, the commanding general, no, we're not doing it that way. We've gotten directions. We're going to do these sole source ones. And, of course, the first ones that were issued were Vice President Cheney's old company, Halliburton.
And at least your sources point back to meetings within the vice president's office about these contracts, although the vice president says he's not ever been involved in this.
Well, and of course now the emails from the White House have suddenly become erased, and it's going to be hard to, unless hopefully somebody down in the bowels of the White House that knows how these things work, just kind of like those tapes during the Nixon administration. Hopefully there's a good, honest, patriotic American that's been working in the White House that has somehow preserved all this stuff that the administration says has now been erased.
Making these allegations, these are very serious allegations, or even just printing other people's allegations may discredit you in many people's minds as being a conspiracy theorist, someone who just has an agenda, who just doesn't like the Bush administration. How would you answer that?
Well, I would answer it that I've been a part of 8 administrations. I was a part of the first Bush administration the first 2 years. I volunteered to go to Kabul, Afghanistan, and reopen the embassy there and went in there and stayed for 5 months. I've been a part of the government, and I would say it's what I am doing is not based on a political agenda. It's based on an agenda for our Constitution and protecting what I always thought that I had served my government for.
And you've been cited for heroism by the U.S. government. I should point that out. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Let's go to Rick in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Mike.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to make a quick comment about the why people haven't been investigated and why nobody's been called up to testify about this. And the reason that I hear mostly is that it would cause a huge upheaval in our country, and that we really don't want to do that. And my comment on that is that if a country was ever ripe for upheaval, it's this one.
Yeah, we've heard that. We heard this in the immediate aftermath of Watergate when President Nixon resigned. I think President Ford and many other forces were saying, we don't want to pursue this because it would cause great upheaval in our government. What do you suppose that really means in our country, a great upheaval in our country? Do you think the American people are so weak that we could not withstand an investigation of wrongdoing at the highest levels of government? Or is it that there is so much wrongdoing at the highest levels of government that our system would collapse on itself because we wouldn't be able to trust anybody or anything?
Well, I think people right now are having great difficulty trusting the government, and I believe an investigation would clear the air, that we would finally know what's going on, and if accountability is held for proven wrongdoing, then it gets us back onto a path that we can believe in our government again. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee you that if nothing is done after the abuses that we've seen of these last 7 years, the American public will never believe its government.
Well, it's clear it's not going to happen before the election. It's fairly clear it's not going to happen before the next president is inaugurated, whoever that might be. Is there any point in doing it after the next president is inaugurated, whether it's John McCain or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama?
I certainly think there is. I mean, if you can't have accountability, then what? I mean, even in our family lives, I mean, you got to have accountability for to keep good order, to follow the rules, so to speak, to follow the Constitution. And if you start letting people get away with things, then the next group, whether it's Republican or Democrat, they're going to say, well, the American public doesn't really care. We'll see if we can expand what we can do, little extra legal things. They don't care. They, you know, they didn't do anything to George Bush and Dick Cheney after they started an illegal war, after they tortured people and all these things. So I think it is critically important that we have accountability.
Let's go to Edie in Concord. Welcome.
Colonel Wright, I admire you very much. My question has to do more with North Carolina's role with extraordinary rendition flights. A lot of people aren't aware that North Carolina is home to one of the largest contractors of the jets that transport people and disappears them, basically, into places like countries like Egypt where they're tortured. And there's an organization called NC Stop Torture Now that's been working on this. And we've gotten as far as to have Representative Watt question FBI Director Mueller at the Oversight Hearing Committee up in Washington. His response in writing to Representative Watt was, when the FBI received a request by the State Attorney General's office to investigate Aero contractors, they discussed it, didn't really know what to do about it, so they gave it to the Justice Department, where it sat for a year and a half. What do we do, or how do we follow up on these things when there's clear, well-documented illegal activity going on in our state, but the system, the FBI, the Justice Department, is doing nothing about it?
Well, I think you keep pushing and keep pushing, and you look at other places, too. I mean, the Italians right now have a court case against 27 CIA agents and one U.S. Army colonel for the kidnapping and extraordinary rendition of a person who was then sent to Egypt and was tortured there. So I would say just keep after it. Keep going with it, because these groups that have been working for the U.S. government to do illegal actions, they must be held accountable too.
Thank you for your call, Edie. Frank in Charlotte writes, please ask Colonel Wright about what the Geneva Convention says about combatants caught behind enemy lines out of uniform. Also ask her how the Bush administration's policy of keeping unlawful combatants in Guantanamo compares to FDR's treatment of Nazi saboteurs.
Well, those are very good questions. The whole issue of ununiformed people in civilian clothes and how they're fighting, whether they are part of a government force, whether they are a part of a non-government group, which the administration is characterizing Al-Qaeda as a non-state terrorist group. How do you approach that? And I have sympathies on one level with the administration, because these are new times. But I think what we have to also have is a clear understanding that we can't undercut the basic principles of our country as we pursue those who perhaps have committed criminal acts against us. And I say criminal acts. Mm-hmm. You know, we have had other criminal acts, and they and perpetrators have been pursued, not through military operations and the use having to use the Geneva Conventions, but by the use of international law. There have been more people that have been brought to justice after the bombings of the U.S. embassies East Africa, the bombing of the USS Cole, other things been brought by international law enforcement and taken to courts.
Bill Clinton was accused by Republicans and other people who didn't like him of not being friendly to the military, and they told people repeatedly that the military hated President Clinton. How would you characterize the way President Clinton dealt with the military and how the military felt about him versus the way President Bush has treated the military and the way the military feels about President Bush?
Well, that's also a good question. When you have Bill Clinton, who had never served in the military, and one of his first, I mean, his presidential advisors really served him wrong when his very first pronouncement as president that had anything to do with the military was on the issue of gays in the military. Mm-hmm. And he had this don't ask, don't tell policy. Mm-hmm. That was, to me, the wrong way to start out your administration. You look at George Bush, who did serve in the military, but served in the reserves, but did not go to Vietnam. And there is question whether or not he actually fulfilled his reserve commitment or National Guard commitment. And then he sends our military into an invasion and occupation of an oil-rich Arab country that had not attacked the United States, and very poorly prepared and equipped military that's gone in, and without really moving quickly to repair the damage to it by sending people in without the proper personal equipment and unit equipment. It seems like cowboy diplomacy, some people in the military, the propaganda that the administrations use, that maybe that's the way to go about it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of propaganda from the Bush administration that the military really likes Bush because, boy, he knows how to use the military. I would say if you really did a survey of military folks, they are just shaking their heads at what's happened.
You talk about something, only about a minute left here, but you talk about something in this book that was news to me and will probably be news to most of the listeners here, that President Bush actually began the war not in March of 2003, but prior to receiving congressional approval in August of 2002 with secret bombings. How could such a thing be secret?
Well, there was a spike in the numbers of air missions that we had in Iraq. You know, we have had over 400,000 air missions before the war even started during the eight-year period. There was a tremendous spike in the numbers against civil infrastructure as well as military.
Colonel Ann Wright, our guest. Her book is called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, available in bookstores everywhere. I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure,
appreciate
Mike.
It very
thanks.
Much.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our program is made possible in part today by Carolina's Medical Center, recognized by the National Research Corporation Survey of Area Residents as a preferred hospital for 9 years. CarolinasMedicalCenter.org, uncompromising excellence, commitment to care. And by Kennesaw State University, 16-month executive master's degree in conflict management, providing knowledge and skills to manage conflict in careers and personal lives. Kennesaw.edu/conflict.
The effect of the U.S. housing bust doesn't stop at the border. In Canada, the lumber industry is reeling. On Vancouver Island, sawmills are closing.
There's so many mills going down, there's another 550 jobs gone. You know, the forest industry built this island, and we're just watching it go away.
Canada's lumber crisis, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on 90.7 FM, WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte's crime rate, gasoline prices, the presidential race, just three things we could talk about during our next session of Open Phones. That just happens to be tomorrow. How are gasoline prices impacting you? Should Hillary Clinton stay in the race all the way to the convention? What do you think should be done to reduce crime? And do you think a new Charlotte police chief will help reduce crime here? Some suggestions, but you choose the topic when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. We have a lake wind advisory in effect till 6 p.m. tonight. Cloudy, scattered showers and thunderstorms today. Breezy highs in the lower 80s. More thunderstorms tonight. Mid-50s. It's 71 now. At WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.